You're listening to Black Op Radio.
Video computers online. Archiving 44K. Initiate sequence.
T-minus 30 seconds.
Server connection confirmed.
T-minus 25 seconds.
Live stream for T-120K.
T-minus 20 seconds.
Phone lines are go.
T-minus 15 seconds.
Satellite uplink verified.
T-minus 10 seconds.
Flight check complete. Satellite uplink verified.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Welcome to Black Op Radio, the voice of political conspiracy research. You're listening to Black Op Radio, the show NSA doesn't want you to hear. Now here is your host, Leno Sanic.
Control room, you're on the air.
Hello everyone, welcome to another episode of Black Op Radio. Today we are speaking to John Washburn. And there's a couple articles up at Kennedy's and King. And welcome to the show, John.
Thanks very much, Len. Thank you for having me again.
Very good. Well, let's get right into it. I'll turn it over to you.
Yeah, I've got two articles here that have recently gone up, thanks much to James de Eugenio. The first is Domingo Benavides. Now, what I've tried to do, as with all my articles, I'm looking at the context in how witnesses were treated, as well as what witnesses said. And in that, I've looked at the timeline of evidence and how that ties in with the choreography of the Warren Commission. And it's particularly interesting in the case of Domingo Benavides. He was the closest eyewitness to the shooting of Officer Tippett. He arrived in his truck. He said that the shots started going off when he was about 25 feet away. He put his brakes on and he pulled to a halt about 15 feet from Tippett's car. Now, that contrasts Helen Markham, who was a good 100 feet plus away on the corner of East 10th and Patton. What's interesting is that Benavides went from being excluded from the narrative during late November 1963 to being included when he appeared on the 2nd of April 1964 before the commission. That was in Dallas. His 22nd of November 1963 affidavit and FBI statements are missing, which in itself is very interesting. We know that they exist because they're referred to in an FBI document from 1967. Detective Jim Lavelle, who led the Tippett murder inquiry, left a big hole in his November 1963 written account of Benavides because he just referred to Benavides in terms as he went to the scene of the shooting and picked up two empty holes and gave them to Officer Poe. Well, clearly Benavides didn't go to the scene of the shooting. He was actually at the scene of the shooting when it happened. The passing on of the holes happened later. Lavelle was definitely trying to airbrush him out because when Lavelle testified to the commission on the 7th of April, he got put on the spot by Counsel Ball, who in my view was one of the better counsel of the commission. Firstly, Ball had to drag out of Lavelle that Benavides was there at all, and then Lavelle had to concede that point. But then Ball had to drag it out of him again. Benavides did more than merely find the empty holes, that he actually was an eyewitness to the shooting itself. What's then linked is we then get to Doris Holan. She lived on Patton at 113.5 South Patton Street, which is behind the houses where the murder of Tippett happened, behind and across. So where she would have been able to see the rear of 410 East 10th because she was in an apartment on the second floor. She basically said she heard the shots and saw a police car reversing in the driveway behind 110 East 10th, which led to the alley between 10th and Jefferson. I call it Lansing Alley, as it's the extension of Lansing Street, and there's continuous telegraph poles over many blocks. But really, although it's an alley, it is Lansing Street. Holan was officially organised by police. There's no contemporaneous records of her. But her son, Lad Holan, has recently said that she had been filmed speaking to police on the day itself. Various devices have been used to discredit her, including putting her in the wrong house, i.e. in the street of East 10th, where she wouldn't have been able to see the rear, but also claims that there was no such driveway as a structure was blocking it. Researcher Del Miles has gone down that line of attack. But as I've shown in my article, the aerial photograph taken by the FBI doesn't have a structure that would block that alley, but the FBI map does. Also, we know there was an alley there, a passageway of some kind, because Benavidez referred to the alley as a street alley between the two houses, as it led to his mother's house on the Lansing Alley. Best to look at my article to see the geography of it. What is interesting is that the Myers position was very keen to discredit the Holan story on geography, but what Myers hasn't done in his article is identify that the aerial photo and the FBI map don't agree by any stretch of the imagination. The FBI map actually shows two buildings blocking what would be the extension of the driveway. But actually, if you look, it doesn't extend onto the driveway. And it's a lot of what's in the rear of 404 East 10th is actually two parked cars. Also, I've noticed over the months I've been doing my research, Myers doesn't bring in stuff into his research from the commission's own files that actually undermine the commission's own position and conclusions, such as what I've just described about Ball and Lavelle. And also, I've never seen him examine large holes in the stories of some police officers, particularly Jerry Hill, Captain Westbrook, Sergeant Croy. So what we had, going back to Benavidez, is that initially he was out of the picture and Markham was in as effectively the star witness. She gave evidence in Washington itself before the members of the commission itself, which included Warren and Dulles and Gerald Ford. But what then happened was shortly after Markham had testified, Benavidez was brought back into the picture and Markham was downgraded. As I cover in my article, it's quite clear the commission didn't have a lot of documentation on Benavidez because they persistently misspelled his name, which is something you wouldn't do if you had it written down in front of you on contemporaneous evidence from the police from November. I'll be covering Markham separately in a forthcoming article because I bring in new information too as to why she wasn't reliable. So what this then really boils down to is bringing stuff from some of my prior articles is the sensitivity against the official line of cars. We had car 207, which is the car that Earlene Roberts, the housekeeper at Oswald's rooming house, said that she saw pull up and toot just before Oswald, who she thought was Oswald, left at approximately 3 minutes past one, which is 33 minutes after Kennedy's assassination. The investigation perpetually tried to obfuscate the car's number, but they never came up with an innocent alternative as to what car it could have been. So even if she was wrong on the number, there was no alternative car that could have been instead of car 207. But all her early written testimonies and FBI interviews are very clear that what she saw was 207. 207 is interesting because Jerry Hill can be seen getting out of car 207 in TV footage at the depository at about 12:50 p.m., 20 minutes after the assassination. And then, therefore, it is a remarkable coincidence that it was car 207 that was seen outside Oswald's rooming house by Earlene Roberts. In terms of the whereabouts of car 207, it was Captain Westbrook who gave the alibi for the car, rather than the allocated officer for that day, Valentine. And as I cover later, Westbrook can't give credible answers as to how he got to the depository, how he got to the Tibbet murder scene, nor even how he got to the Texas Theatre. Hill said that he arrived with Owens at the murder scene, having heard the announcement on the radio. Owens didn't verify Hill's story. In fact, Owens said that Westbrook and the district attorney, Bill Alexander, came with him. Hill also said that he was interviewing witnesses when he saw Poe's car pull up, but Poe had arrived immediately before Owens, so there's a double contradiction for Hill here. He can't have seen something that had happened before he had arrived officially if he'd arrived with Owens. So he's a problem on who his driver was and the timing of how he got there. We then have Croy, who from his Warren Commission testimony, which was really an accident because he was only supposed to be testifying on the assassination of Oswald on the Sunday, but he'd let slip when he was chatting up the stenographer that he'd been around on assassination day as well, which is partly why I think his story was just so bizarre and had so many holes in it, because he couldn't really make up on the spot a credible story that would have less holes in it, even if it was untrue. So per Sergeant Owens, Westbrook had arrived with him, but Westbrook said he'd arrived with Sergeant Stringer and an unknown driver. But there's another story that reporter Jim Ewell, he said this later publicly, that he arrived from Dealey Plaza with Stringer in a car with Westbrook driving. So what does that all that mean? There's a lot of pieces that don't seem to fit together, but I actually think they can be slotted together. So my analysis concludes this. I believe that Croy and Hill arrived in car 207 and drove it to the rear of the Tippett murder scene. They had carried the assailant who shot Tippett from Oswald's rooming house. And several witnesses at the murder scene referred to police being on the scene very early, before the ambulance had arrived. Well, the ambulance arrived 3 minutes after the shooting because its base was only one block away. And it was then another 4 minutes after that that Poe arrived, and then Owens arrived with Westbrook. So I conclude that Hill and Croy were effectively involved in the ambush of Tippett by carrying the assailant who shot him. And what Doris Holand saw was them taking that car to the rear so it wouldn't be seen by people in the street. I then believe that what happened was Westbrook took car 207 back to the depositories because it would have stuck out like a sore thumb. And also somebody might notice it was missing. And then I believe Westbrook arrived again, just as Ewell said. And in fact, Westbrook can be heard on the patrol radio at around about 1:30 p.m. saying things such as "who's in charge around here," as if he'd first arrived, when actually he'd arrived at around 1:16 p.m. That was his first arrival. So Westbrook's journey overall that day had three relevant legs: City Hall to the depository to the Tippett murder scene, and then the Tippett murder scene to the Texas Theatre. All three of accounts he gave can be proven to be wrong. He said he walked from City Hall to the depository, which is over a mile, but he let slip that he used the patrol radio when he got there. And he also let slip that he'd arrived with somebody else because he used the term "we." He clearly obfuscated how he got to Oak Cliff. He partly combined two journeys as one vague one. He pretended he didn't know who the driver was, and he claimed to have gone with Stringer, when we know that he actually went with Stringer for the second time and Owens had taken him on the first time. Westbrook did the same when he described how he got to the Texas Theatre. He said Stringer and an unknown driver took him and drove the car to the back. But Jim Ewell, the journalist from the Dallas Morning News, said Westbrook drove him and Stringer and parked at the front. In fact, many researchers have got photographs of Westbrook's car being parked at the front. So Westbrook has clearly got a sensitivity about the cars he was using that day, because how did he get there? Effectively, how do you create a cover story for actually having two journeys, one which was known by Officer Owens and the other which was only really known to Westbrook and the people in his car for the second journey? A lot of this relies on the reliability of Owens as being sure that Westbrook was in his car and Hill wasn't. But I believe Owens is sufficiently inconvenient an officer in several ways. First of all, he gives inconvenient statements in his testimonies, and I found nothing to be untruthful. But also, Owens was supposed to be in command of Tippett on that day for the whole of the shift. But at some time just before lunch, his control was switched to Sergeant Hugh Davis. Hugh Davis is radio patrol invisible that day, which is odd for somebody who's supposed to be in charge of half a dozen or more police officers, not least one of whom then gets shot. At one point, you can actually hear Owens asking where Davis is, because Owens thinks it's Davis who needs to take charge of telling Tippett's wife that he's been shot. But Davis is silent. He doesn't appear. So logically, if Tippett was operating to clandestine activity in Oak Cliff, then Davis is the person who'd be telling him what to do. And Owens being moved off of that duty that day, to me, vindicates Owens' position as somebody who wasn't involved in anything nefarious. He may have turned a blind eye to things, but that very often happens when there's cover-ups. But there must have been a reason for switching Owens' command that day to somebody else who then is invisible. So in summary, I've talked about Westbrook and Hill having inadequate stories as to how they got to the Tippett murder scene. But there's also the invisibility of Hugh Davis. And in my prior article, I refer to Tippett's position at GLOCO shortly after Kennedy is assassinated, heading off in the direction of Lancaster and 8th, and then making a radio call from Lansing and 8th. Essentially, I think that was to set up the ambush for Tippett. So at some point after the assassination, I think Tippett did something that made him a massive liability to the conspiracy. Davis was in on it. Tippett was possibly only partly in on it, had been duped into something that he thought might be something else. Perhaps he thought it would be a false flag operation. Perhaps he thought that only Connolly would be shot. But something happened to make Tippett turn, and the evidence points to Tippett being taken out as part of effectively a post-assassination cleanup operation. And that scenario does explain why lots of other things go wrong. I believe Oswald was a patsy. If you're trying to kill a president, then you would have to have a patsy. Otherwise, there'd be a relentless search to find the true perpetrator. So any assassination would need a patsy. Patsy would need to be eliminated because they would obviously speak. I also believe that you would need a decoy to do some things that the patsy wouldn't do themselves, i.e. create a parallel journey that would look like they'd arrived at the Texas Theater by bus and by foot, whereas Oswald had actually been taken there under a false pretense, not knowing that he was being set up. I think that's the end of what I want to say, Len, if you've got any questions.
Well, it's really just goes to show that the idea of the patsy, I mean, all these things had to be blamed on somebody. It's really astounding the legwork that, you know, researchers and such as yourself have dug up all these little facts that they don't poke holes in the story. They just obliterate it.
Yeah, I think they do. I'm appalled at the quality of what I call the pro-commission research. It follows what I call inductive reasoning. Another expression is motivated reasoning. You just carry on telling the story that suits your position, your agenda, despite how many contradictions and falsehoods and things that carries along the way. I mean, as we know, some commission members didn't believe the outcome of the commission, but we know there was an element of coercion given the linkage, the sort of false linkage with Soviet activity, and that there would be a nuclear war if it was found that the Soviets...
Yeah, I laugh at that. I can't believe that. I think, oh yeah, don't let the American public know that a Soviet agent killed us, because we'd have to go to war. Meanwhile, what's the defense budget for, you know, preventing this? That's the way I look at it. Like, oh, Lyndon Johnson's telling everybody, you know, 40 million people will be killed and all that. But what else are you arming up for?
Yep. What's interesting, and it's particularly useful given that in a day of YouTube and the internet, it's easier to do research than it was in the past, because you had to go to a public library of a sufficient size to get the Warren Report itself, et cetera, et cetera. And you couldn't cross-link everything in the same place. I think Sylvia Meagher did a brilliant job in the 1960s in pulling so many holes at an early stage. And one big problem I had with the House Select Committee on Assassinations work in the 1970s is they didn't build on the work of Sylvia Meagher, which was clearly pointing out holes. In fact, I think the work of that Select Committee on Assassinations in the 70s was actually worse than the groundwork that was put into the Warren Commission report, because as I've been finding, a lot of the stuff is there, hidden away. Honest FBI officers took some testimonies. Honest police officers made some statements. There's a relatively small core that was pulling together the false narrative. But I think if you actually look at the facts and curate it properly, you can come up with a much better explanation of what was going on than the Warren Commission, even despite the fact that some of the Warren Commission evidence has clearly been played around with and doctored. One thing that I found interesting the other day is an interview with Kilduff, who was Kennedy's press officer, who actually put out the statement that Kennedy had died around about 1:30. He says that he went to Lyndon Johnson to say that he wanted to put out the announcement that the president was dead. And the first thing, that Kilduff said he was aware of was right-wing risk to Kennedy in Dallas and Texas. Johnson said, "It's the communists." Very, very interesting to say. Johnson instantly wanted to close down any sense that it was a right-wing plot, even though that was clearly a risk, and wanted it to be effectively a communist plot, which I find very, very interesting. I that indicates to me that Johnson had a very, very good idea as to what was going to happen.
Well, I think they would have been quick to blame it on Cuba too.
Yeah, I think the more and more I look at this, I think it's impossible not to believe that Johnson wasn't aware of it. And I think the more we now know about Johnson's involvement with criminality, his ethics, stories that he'd actually arranged for somebody to be shot, possibly even his own sister murdered, that this would have been sort of nothing really in terms of his overall moral compass to do, because he was clearly the main beneficiary of Kennedy being dead, and Kennedy was going to withdraw him from the ticket for the next election. So the more and more you look at the Warren Commission report, that cannot have got out in its final form without effectively Johnson turning a blind eye and not wanting a proper investigation. That's very clear.
Right. Well, he was their guy because he went along with whatever, even if he wasn't the main motivating force. He was just, he hated the Kennedys, and yeah.
Yeah, I think it's wrong to say it was the mob that did it, or it was the CIA that did it. To say it was the CIA that did it is actually kind of a bit naive in terms of how organizations work. I mean, I think rogue elements of the CIA were involved, but that doesn't mean the CIA did it.
Right. Well, but you're implying it's not the whole building and institution. But
exactly.
then again, Alan Dulles was retired by Kennedy, and he had a real grudge. You know, he'd be only too willing to help.
Well, if people want a parallel as well, it's worth watching something. Harold Wilson was actually the most successful British Labour Prime Minister, but he was elected in 1964. Then he was elected again in 1966. He lost in 1970, but he then won again in 1974 with a small majority. He then went to the country again later that year, and he won again. And he retired in 1976 because he had early diagnosis of Alzheimer's. But during the late 1960s, he became convinced that there was a rogue cell within MI5. To stage a coup against him. And interestingly, the link with the Kennedy case is Angleton, James Angleton. James Angleton was absolutely convinced that Wilson was a Soviet asset, because Wilson had become leader because Hugh Gaitskell, the then leader of the Labour Party, made a visit to Moscow and died very shortly afterwards with a very rare disease, literally within a week. And that's how Wilson became the leader. And Wilson actually gave covert interviews to BBC journalists to give his side of the story well before his side of the story became public. So he laid the groundwork for all this. And it's effectively been proven to be correct that there was a rogue element that was prepared to effectively orchestrate a coup against Wilson. So there's nothing new, is what I'm saying.
Yeah, rogue always sounds funny to me, the rogue element. You wonder, like, oh, what percentage is that? Is that maybe half of them? Or is just like three or four? But like you're implying, the building, the institution of the intelligence agency. But Anyway, all right. So that is, your article is up at Kennedy's and King, Under the Death of Tippit, Part 4 and 5.
Yep. Benavides is Part 4 and Holden is Part 5.
Okay, well, I'm just going to urge people, look at that. There's a couple of charts on here and all that. And, of course, Westbrook and Croy. John Armstrong's got into a bit of that as well, you know. And so many people that lay the groundwork for, you know, there had to be a patsy. And there had to be some kind of cover-up. And like you mentioned, maybe that Tippit ran into something that he went, no, wait a minute, you know, I can't go along with this.
John Armstrong's work has really been groundbreaking in this, because it was really John who picked up the suspicious movements of Hill, Croy, and Westbrook. Well, I disagree with John is he put Westbrook and Croy in the car. I think if we believe Owens, then Westbrook wasn't in the same car as Croy and Hill. Westbrook actually did arrive with Owens, so that excludes Westbrook from actually being present when Tippit was shot. But I've got no doubt that Westbrook was actually in charge of the rogue operation within the Dallas Police Force. Some of my other articles have covered the suspicious movements of other officers in Oak Cliff, which I think was to secure the getaways. We had half a dozen officers that were just not where they should be. And that was covered up by mistranscription, forced transcription, etc., etc. So their true position can be found from the radio tapes if you actually track them, rather than rely on the transcription. So I think Westbrook was in charge of the overall infiltration of the Dallas police. It was relatively few people. I mean, I think that the Tippit thing was pulled off with just really Westbrook having to improvise on the spot with Croy, Hill, and whoever was in the car. I believe it was Larry Crayford, which I've touched on in other articles, and Benavides' description matches Crayford far better than any description of Oswald. But, yeah.
Very good. Well, I'll make links to those articles as well. Okay. Well, I guess that covers it up for today. What's the better word for that? I'll have to cut this out. It's a good summary for today, and I'll urge everyone to go to Kennedy's and King and read in case we missed a few things here. And, of course, you've got links to a lot of things too, right? So, like you mentioned, sometimes the transcription is not exactly correct, you know, and you've got to go back and read or listen to what was actually said on the tapes.
Oh yeah, the mistranscriptions in the tape are quite clear. I mean, Lancaster, whether you say it with a British accent or an American accent, is a very different word to Lansing. The only commonality is they both begin with L, and one's got two syllables, one's got three. And if anything, the American way of pronouncing it puts more expression on the R than we do. So when Tippit says Lance in eighth, he's not saying Lancaster. There's just no way. And I've covered in previous articles what I think was going on at Lancaster in eighth. I think there was, Lansing in eighth. I think there was some sort of op center there to sort of manage the operations that day. And I believe that's where Hugh Davis was, and that's why Tippit went there. And I think Tippit was held outside whilst they were thinking how would they deal with him, and what second sort of story of lies would they tell him?
Yeah, scenario.
To set him up for rapid elimination.
All right. Okay, well, thank you so much for your good work and writing and taking time to talk to me today about this, and I'll make links to the recent updates here at Kennedy's and King.
Thank you. Thanks, Len.
Okay, very good.
Great.